Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS. I want to welcome you all. I want to say a special thanks to Akwe Amosu at the Open Society Institute and to Leslie Lefko of Human Rights Watch for helping co-host and co-organize this event. Thank you also to the Ford Foundation, who has made for us here at CSIS a series on East Africa and the Horn, security and human rights issues possible. And a thanks to Dave Hennick, who pulled all this together, who works here in the Africa program at CSIS. And I want to thank all our panelists on this panel and the next for coming long distances to be with us and share their thoughts with us. The name of the event, we've called it Kenya Revisited. It may be not a great title because I think in some ways we should never have left Kenya. After the electoral crisis of last year, there was a very quick international response. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Jendai Fraser, a series of African Union leaders came to Nairobi. The work of Kofi Annan, which was really, I think, instrumental, that tremendous amount of effort and time he invested in the crisis. But as usual, I think our, at least U.S. attention, eventually drifted away from Kenya. I think there's been a tendency throughout Kenya's history to take Kenya for granted, despite all the very important interests the United States has there, security, democracy, and other. I think there's a tendency to think, well, Kenya will muddle through this eventually. It goes to the brink and then it muddles through. Well, in this last instance, it came at the cost of over 1,500 lives, many more injured, and thousands upon thousands displaced. And so I think the crisis should have been a wake-up call that Kenya doesn't just muddle through, that there are real issues at stake, and it's a very fragile place. What we thought we'd do in this first panel is take a look back at what's happened since the election crisis. We have a terrific panel, and I'll introduce them in a moment. Well, why don't I introduce them now? Well, first, we'll have Salim Lone, who is informal independent advisor to the Prime Minister, Raila Odinga. He has a long career as a journalist, which is in the capacity which I first met him. He's gone back to that as well and is now writing a book, I think, looking back on the crisis and what it may mean for the future. I think Salim's going to talk a little bit about the big political picture, the status of the unity government, how it's performed, and whether it's getting on with the process of governing or still, I think, enmeshed in dealing with the aftermath of the crisis. We also then have Gladwell Ochieno, and we're delighted to have her. She's a founding member of the Africa Center for Open Governance, known as AFRICOG. She's the former head of Transparency International, where she was a very outspoken anti-corruption campaigner and has a great career there. She had worked with the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa. I'm not going to go through the entire, I think you have her bio here. Needless to say, just a really strong voice on a lot of these corruption and reform issues. And Gladwell, thanks so much for being here. And then we have Ben Rollins, a researcher for Human Rights Watch since January 2008, so was thrown right into the thick of it. Before that, working on Nigeria and Uganda. And prior to that, he was an advisor to opposition political parties in Tanzania and in the UK. And Ben's been doing a lot of work on the issues of violence, whether Eldoret in Mount Elgon, the recently released Alston report on some of the police killings and so forth. And Ben, we're looking forward to that. Why don't we start out with Salim? We'll have speakers speak for about 10 to 15 minutes and then open for questions before moving to the next panel.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, CSIS, as well as Open Society, for organizing this. It's extremely timely. I know you organized it because it's a year since the crisis sort of was resolved, so to speak. But as it happens, there is another crisis, and it's brewing quite rapidly. So this is very, very timely. There's a lot of soul-searching going on at home about what to do, about our divisions in government, about the paralysis in government. We had thought that this government in the first year, the coalition government, because it combined President Kibaki's sort of continuity and a sure hand, a person who was very seasoned in politics and in leadership, with Mr. Raila Odinga's drive for reform. But instead, we have seen that things have not worked out as we had thought. Doesn't mean we should give up. But really, there is a division and paralysis in the government in the face of serious problems for ordinary Kenyans. At the same time, I think there is a serious problem with the international community as well, because it seems to be paralyzed. It sort of issues statements once in a while, the American ambassador in particular, and I want to dwell a little bit later on the U.S. role in this whole, both resolving the crisis and perhaps in some ways not helping the crisis. He is very active and he's speaking all the time on issues. I mean, in my view, sometimes he goes far too far, much too far, by taking positions such as Kenyans don't need a grand opposition. I mean, that's not the role of the U.S. ambassador to tell Kenyans whether they need opposition or not. But there is a paralysis all over, and I hope, therefore, that in this conference we will be able to come up with some concrete proposals, not only for us as Kenyans, but also for the international community, and also for Mr. Kofi Annan. As you rightly said, Kenyans owe so much to Mr. Annan. I worked with him at the UN, and I really believe, quite genuinely, not because I'm a Kenyan, that what he achieved in Kenya, he did not achieve as Secretary General. Here he single-handedly, really, with the help of the international community, of course, he single-handedly was able to bring the two parties together and to avoid a much greater conflagration than took place. So he's, as you know, having a very major conference at the end of this month, 30 and 31st March, in Geneva. And I'm sure, I'm not saying it because I talked to him about this, but I'm sure he would value anything that we come up with. I also hope there are some Obama administration people here, because this is his country, even though he hasn't spent much time there. And even though he might not say it, I'm sure he's very interested in following closely what happens in Kenya. So I will speak. I'm no longer working for ODM. I was a spokesman for the Prime Minister for a long time, for about a year, before I resigned at the end of September. But I still advise him on and off. And, of course, I will speak from an ODM perspective, because the perspective I know best, but I'm not speaking for ODM. I'm independent now. But I'm very glad to see that Peter Gwanjo is here, who has the PNU leaning. So I was hoping we'd be together on the panel so we could have a fist fight or something. But okay. I want to address, apart from a brief history of where the coalition government is, three issues. One is how the power-sharing agreement has never materialized, actually. People think it's breaking down, but it never materialized, number one. Number two, I want to address the issue of the tribunal, which I believe the tribunal, I mean, I assume everybody sort of knows what I'm talking about when I say the tribunal. It's, yes, people do. I don't have to describe it. Right, okay. So I'll say something about the tribunal, and as I said earlier, a little bit about the U.S. role. So let me begin, first of all, with the crisis that has developed over the year. As I speak, you probably don't know, there is a considerable amount of unrest and violence going on right now, connected to the Mungiki issue. Some Mungiki followers were supposedly killed because they were extorting, etc. In turn, then Mungiki, or factions of the Mungiki, you never know. I mean, maybe Maina will tell us more about Mungiki when he speaks. But the Oscar Foundation, which is a foundation which has highlighted Mungiki issues, two of its officials were killed this morning in demonstrations. So the issue of Mungiki has come to the fore because of the report by Philip Alston. I'm sure most of you know Professor Alston as being an outstanding and very, very thoughtful and sharp person who's done wonderful reports in many countries. But at the moment, the government is under severe pressure from his report, because in addition to pointing out how many people were executed by the police in cold blood, how widespread it was and how systematic it was, he said he asked for the resignation of the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Police. That is not normal for him. This is not the kind of thing he goes into a country and says. And let me say that, without meaning to embarrass him, but a source I know very well, he told that person, who is very credible to me, that he was shocked at what he saw. He knew things were bad because he read about it, but he was shocked at what he saw. And he thinks Kenya is just about the only country in the world where this kind of executions are taking place. And, you know, most of us think that Kenya is, on the whole, a very nice, friendly place, except when crises are there. So, and he also criticized the president. He said the president had not spoken out about this issue, and he urged him to speak about extrajudicial killings. So this is a tense time, and it's particularly tense because we have so many other issues. One, the government paralysis is serious. We all knew that while the trigger for the violence that erupted last year was the rigged election, we also knew right away that those who rioted and killed and did terrible things did so because of the accumulation of grievances, injustice, loss of land, et cetera, et cetera. So this government, the coalition, was formed to address those underlying issues very quickly. And for a lot of us, and not just because I worked for him, we thought that Raila Odinga was the only leader who could deliver change to Kenya amongst the leaders. I'm sure there are younger people coming up who will one day wear that kind of mantle. But he was the only one we thought who could deliver. And since he was united with President Kibaki, we thought there would be a unified support for the reforms that are in sort of they have to happen, or Kenya will go down the drain. But the reality is that not only has very little happened on those festering issues, new issues have come up under the tutelage of this government. A high level of corruption, food prices which are higher than they've ever been. In addition, there is famine and hunger. 10 million people, according to the government, the president said that this was a national disaster. 10 million Kenyans who are not able to feed themselves. So this is there are serious issues here that need to be addressed very quickly. As you said, Jennifer, Kenya is important to the international community. Right after the violence broke out, Mr. Gordon Brown called the Prime Minister, called the President, Ms. Rice, the same, and numerous other leaders. The AU chairman showed up right away, Desmond Tutu. Anyway, everybody converged. And, you know, in Africa, we have a very regrettable history of crises just going out of control before the world gets involved. I mean, Rwanda, the world never got involved. You know, 800,000 people dead. Somalia, DRC, I mean, you name it. Mozambique, things get bad and worse, and even then there is no solution. In Kenya's case, there was immediate tension because I think everybody realizes Kenya is crucial not for itself but also for that entire region. It is very, very important. And if Kenya goes, it will be a huge blow to all of Africa. So there was immediate attention. And we thought we had found a wonderful solution. Well, the solution, as it turns out, was not so wonderful because of the way it was implemented. As you know, the heart of the accord was equal power sharing. And it was very difficult to get that accord. We had to have Condoleezza Rice come to Nairobi to make sure that it was agreed on. But once the accord was signed, Mr. Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, and ODM were left to negotiate the power sharing with the president and at that time the PNU government. And you know that it is not possible for opposition leaders to have much sway when they face the might of the state. So I believe the implementation of the accord meant that Raila Odinga had very little authority. I think this is not in dispute. He has no executive power. In fact, a civil servant, the chief of the civil service, and Secretary of the Cabinet, Mr. Massara, has infinitely greater power to act, to appoint people, and et cetera. So this, I believe, I don't want to go into details, I can answer questions later. While Mr. Odinga has made many mistakes, and while ODM has made many mistakes, I'm not here to defend ODM. There are plenty of bad stuff going on both sides. The reality is that the person who thought he was going to drive reforms ended up without any executive authority. But in the beginning, you know, he's a very sort of dynamic person, a lot of energy, etc. He seemed to be doing well. The first thing he did, some of you might remember, is he said we should talk to the Mungiki. A year ago, he said we should talk because he realized what a terrible... I'm not defending Mungiki, don't misunderstand what I'm saying, but Mungiki, they have killers and murderers amongst them, terrible people, but there seemed to be no solution to the problem. They have a lot of support. They have a lot of membership. Some say in the millions. So he immediately did this. He took on some other very important issues. For example, he took on the issue of the Mau Forest, which is the large water catchment area for Kenya, out of which our five main rivers flow. Despite the risk that posed to his base, because that's in the Rift Valley, and a lot of Rift Valley people thought, why are you trying to evict people from the Mau in the name of environment, so to speak? There are tens of thousands of people whose livelihood depends upon on living there. He also, in order to... He was greatly demonized. And during his entire career, he spent many, many years in jail, solitary confinement, torture, etc. But he'd been demonized as a tribalist, as a dictator, etc., and as a socialist, Marxist. His son's name is Fidel Castro Odinga. Yeah. So he wanted to show that this was all false, and he embraced the private sector in a way that even President Kibaki had never done. So he had some initial breakthroughs, not successes. But eventually, he took on the issue of food, which was going through the roof, and he said we'd somehow find a subsidized way to make it easier for poor people to afford. And even that that collapsed. It didn't work out. So how can you rely on him to do anything when he has no power to do so? So that's one issue. And I believe there's an answer. There's a very clear answer, and I hope all of you will agree that it is time to reopen that accord and to provide the Prime Minister, if we are serious, who is supposed to be sharing power. This is an equally power-shared government, supposed to be. We must provide him with some authority to act. That is not the only basis for the problems, not at all. I'm not trying to put a gloss over things. But for sure, if the person who is in charge of certain things gets repeatedly frustrated and is seen not to have power, not only do PNU ministers don't listen to him, even some ODM ministers, seeing that he doesn't have the authority to do that much, are beginning to challenge him because who is he after all? He's just another minister, so to speak, yeah. And a minister, there was a terrible, I think you know, that amongst the many crises we face, fundamental crisis, is we are still not allowed to peacefully demonstrate. Whoever demonstrates is attacked violently by the police, and people have been hurt. And these are well-known people. These are not, these are people, leaders of civil society, teachers, etc. There is a new Communications Act now under which the government can close down any broadcaster if it feels it poses a threat. And it happened before. So we have very serious difficulties in Kenya at the moment. And God forbid, if something required a new election, let us assume for some reason we needed a new election within 3 months or 6 months, there'd be chaos in the country because we can't demonstrate, we can't assemble peacefully, the media is under threat, there is no ECK, we are facing problems. Yeah. The other issue I want to discuss, how many minutes do I have?
Well, maybe 5 or 7.
5 or 7. Okay, good. Yeah. Just end me when you're ready, please. I mean it. Yeah. Okay. The other issue, which is much more sensitive, is the issue of the tribunal. I believe that the Waki report, and this is a Kenyan judge who came up with a brilliant report, not only about the killings, but about the underlying causes for these killings, the history of impunity, et cetera, in this country, and the inability of the judiciary, the police executions, et cetera. He proposed that a local tribunal with international involvement be established, and it's the only way to go, in my view. And he said if one is not established, then he had given Mr. Kofi Annan an envelope with some names in it of people who were suspected to be the masterminds behind the killings, that be handed over to the ICC in The Hague. Now, this is my view. If, whether through The Hague, which will take a long time anyway, but especially through a tribunal, which I hope is established, a national tribunal, if we begin to start putting people in jail for the violence that they carried out, terrible violence, some of it, against innocents, while we do nothing about those who rigged the election, it is going to inflame passions in the way one cannot imagine. That those who did the initial big crime are scot-free. No one's even talking about who might have done it, leave alone pursuing that issue. And we're not talking about who won the election. We can ignore that part. But certainly we know rigging was there. Who was behind it? So to punish one group and leave the other one out seems explosive. I think all of you will remember what Colin Powell said to President Bush when he was asked about invading Iraq. Colin Powell said, if you break it, you own it. I'm not sure of the exact words, but meaning if you do this and if it goes wrong, you're responsible for what comes afterwards. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, if you initiate some action which results in a lot of killing, etc., you are certainly to be held to account. And the other reason jailing these people would be explosive is because, especially in the Rift Valley, which is the cradle of our food and etc., if you do not address the very legitimate issues relating to land, about which the Kalenjin feel very strongly, and other communities, very, very strongly, they feel that land has been taken from them that should not have been. If you don't punish the people who did the rigging, if you do nothing about the land issue, which was the principal trigger for the violence, but you decide that the first people we're ever going to punish in the history of our country, because as you know, mass violence has taken place before, mass corruption has taken place before, extrajudicial killings have been taking place in the last year. If we are not going to punish any of those people, but we are going to put in jail people who revolted but then killed, as well as the leaders, that is just too explosive. So I have a very simple solution, and I hope some of you will agree with it. Try the people, expose them, convict them if they're guilty, but give them suspended sentences. Don't jail them. Don't jail them. Mine and I have this ongoing discussion. Yeah. Because you cannot only punish those people and no one else in Kenya. There's too much at stake in doing that. I'm not saying I'm right, but I really think we should discuss this. And unfortunately, the Kenyan public has not been involved at all in this discussion. Nothing is more important than what we do with this issue. In Kenya's history, nothing that we will decide on this one can be compared to anything we've done before. You know, terrible things have happened before, but I'm talking about what we as a nation decide. And so there needs to be a good discussion. I'm very glad that Mr. Annan said he gave us 2 more months. I'm not sure that'll work, because I actually think we need 4 or 5 months, because the statute that was voted upon and defeated had many, many holes in it. So in a way, it hopefully worked out for the better, as long as we can have a tribunal. It's so important that we have a tribunal. So I'll take just 2 more minutes, Yeah, just 2 minutes, because it's a U.S. audience, and I just want to mention the U.S. role. I think all of you are aware, I don't need to tell you, that the U.S. was a very strong supporter of President Kibaki. In fact, to be honest, most Western missions, Western diplomats, were strong supporters of Mr. Kibaki in the election. He was a steady hand, continuity, friendly relations with the West. But the U.S. actually went too far in an election year to show their support for him. And then all of you know the IRI poll, which showed that Odinga had won by a substantial margin, was suppressed on the day of the election. Maybe it would have limited some of the violence. Maybe a different outcome might have been the result instead of the power-sharing accord, which is not working. And then after that, yeah, so both the IRI, the congratulations that U.S., apart from Uganda, was the only country to congratulate Kenya when the EU had prepared such a clear dossier showing there were a lot of irregularities. They might not have been all accurate. So it was very depressing. And what was even more distressing, and again, I can only quote very reliable sources who were in meetings with Mr. Fraser, when she came, she proposed that Mr. Raila Odinga should accept the outcome and wait for 212, because he was a young man still, and there was plenty, you know, he could do as opposition leader, since he had the largest party, 99 members elected, twice as many as PNU. If this is true, and I think it is, it's outrageous that the United States would actively propose that a flawed election should actually be honored. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Salim. Why don't we turn to Gladwell, and we can come back to elaborate on some of those more stirring questions. Gladwell, why don't we turn to you?
Thank you very much. Thank you to the CSIS, sorry, and thank you to the Open Society Foundation.
Institute.
I should know better. Yes. Well, Salim has basically covered a lot of ground, which I then probably don't have to cover, although I obviously, coming from civil society, will have a somewhat different view of things than the representative, well, than someone who was close to a particular party is now an independent advisor, but I think I do have some differences of opinion on some things, and obviously I agree on particular issues. Speaking from the perspective of civil society, from the very early days of the crisis, when just after the announcement of the disputed results, civil society did come together, and not just as organizations, because at that time it was very difficult to gather as organizations. There was very little freedom of movement. There was no freedom of expression. The TVs weren't allowed to broadcast news. We were sort of being fed a diet of Mexican soap operas. But at this time, people came together in response to the crisis. And very early on, there were people meeting who gelled into a coalition, a loose coalition, which eventually called itself Kenyans for Peace with Truth and Justice. At the same time, there were other groups meeting with a more humanitarian focus, perhaps, and others with a focus on just bringing about an end to the violence, and their approach was more to call for simply a cessation of violence, for peace. And the group that came to be called Kenyans for Peace with Truth and Justice, which is the group that I represent, and therefore I'll be talking more about what they do, advanced the position that it would not be possible to have sustainable peace in Kenya without truth and justice. Truth on what happened, particularly to the presidential elections, and accountability for that, justice for that, and truth around the violence that ensued, and accountability and justice for that. And we analyzed the violence as having several strands, part spontaneous protests against what was seen as an unjust result, part organized violence, part retaliatory and also organized violence, and also state violence against citizens, as obviously the Waki report found. And since that time, civil society engaged with the process, conducting advocacy internationally and towards the African Union, publishing statements, pointing out dangers, and trying to keep the various parties focused on the need for progress on the mediation process. The Kenya National Dialogue and Reconciliation Framework basically came up with an agreement around, I think, four agenda points. I don't know how many of you I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but for those of you who aren't, it was basically around four agenda points, and I think that's the line I'll follow in trying to analyze progress since the post-election crisis. Agenda item one was around immediate action to stop violence and restore fundamental rights and liberties. Agenda item two was to address the humanitarian crisis and promote healing and reconciliation. Agenda item three was the political settlement, which Salim has gone into in some detail. And agenda item four referred to the long-standing issues, the underlying triggers of the violence, the underlying issues which lent the violence the sort of impact and the sort of intensity that caught so many of us totally by surprise. And amongst these were named constitutional reform, the need for transitional justice, or dealing with past human rights abuses, addressing inequality, land reform. Salim has referred to the importance and potency of land as a symbol of inequity and a symbol of deprivation and a source of grievances, and addressing the issue of youth, the huge majority of unemployed youth who have been manipulated, many of whom have been manipulated and paid by politicians as shock troops in Kenya's traditionally violent multi-party elections. Out of this process also, various institutional arrangements arose. The independent review of the elections, the so-called Kriegler Commission, which was supposed to look into the conduct of elections and the integrity of the vote. And this was led by Johan Kriegler, a South African judge. The Commission of Inquiry into Post-Election Violence, which came to be known as the Waki Commission, headed by a Kenyan judge, Philip Waki. A Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission bill laid the way for the setting up of a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. Now, out of this, civil society has... I should say something about the composition of these organizations. We were able to respond to various issues because many of our organizations had been doing work on many of these issues. Human rights organizations had been looking at issues of violence, had been looking at issues of repression, governance organizations looking at issues of corruption and issues of institutional reform, gender organizations looking at issues of gender-based violence, etc. So it was easy to mobilize that sort of common analytical resource and use each other's respective capacity to respond to the arising issues and develop positions, which some of which I think became quite influential, conduct analysis around our main focus of the elections, what happened to the elections, and the violence. So on Kriegler, I would say that... it was seen that there were various valuable recommendations made and various valuable contributions, repeating much of what Kenyans had been calling for over the decades. Unfortunately, we don't believe that Justice Kriegler did as thorough a job as he could have done on the issue of the integrity of the vote, leading to that being an unanswered question, not so much in terms of who actually won the election, but what went wrong and who was responsible. Salim has talked about the necessity for accountability in the elections. If one is ever going to be able to address the issues brought up by the past elections and go into future elections with any level of confidence, it would have been valuable to have a much more cogent and thorough and conscientious analysis of what went wrong with the vote. Unfortunately, this didn't happen, and it leaves the way open for arguments to be conducted, which actually may have been, some of them may have been laid to rest. Admittedly, many of them will never be laid to rest, particularly the question of who won, which at this point is actually, I think, irrelevant for many of us. What's relevant is knowing what went wrong and securing accountability for crimes, because without that, you have a continuation of the impunity which has characterized Kenya's political system over the decades and continues to do so even after the post-election crisis and indeed is intensified. The Waki Commission did a commendable job. The Justice Waki was very open to consulting and to questioning and getting information and witness testimony from, including from civil society. And we think he was able to uncover particularly the aspect of gender-based violence because of this open approach to the experiences and networks of civil society. And indeed, he uncovered an alarming level of horrendous gender-based violence, including by the security forces. There were cases listed of women being attacked and raped by the very security forces whom they had turned to expecting help. So the Waki report, we felt, was a very good basis, particularly in its in its setting specific timelines and in making specific recommendations and indeed giving Kenyans a sort of specific framework with which to judge progress on recommendations of the Waki Commission. Salim has referred to the special tribunal, which was to be set up within a certain amount of time. That time has lapsed, and Kofi Annan has seen fit to grant an extension. We're not. I don't think that this is a good idea for that extension to have been granted, because we do feel that minds must be concentrated on the need to address impunity in Kenya. I will not go into the question of local tribunal or the ICC, but what we have been saying so far is that it's important that the leaders of the violence, the financiers of the violence, be held to account, and it's important that this be done, and it's very, very difficult to do that inside Kenya. There must also be accountability by the lower level and middle level perpetrators of the violence, and that can happen in Kenya, we think. And I'll leave it to Ben, and I think afterwards others, to go more into the ins and outs of what has been a very politically manipulated debate around the ICC, local tribunal, special tribunal, etc. I think the argument about sovereignty, for example, that if the ICC were to seize itself of the problems of Kenya, that would be an insult to our sovereignty, doesn't hold any water. What brought us out of our crisis was the involvement, the positive involvement of international partners. And indeed, we would ask for greater and more focused and longer-term involvement. As far as the political settlement is concerned, civil society grappled with the problem that a political settlement was necessary because a greater bloodbath was imminent. There was rearming, there was mobilizing of militias, so there was a need, there was an urgent need for a political settlement to put a stop to that. And that we would consider to be, and indeed generally, Kenyans consider in surveys, they say that the greatest achievement of the of the coalition government has been an end to, well, at least peace. We won't say that violence has ceased, because obviously we're hearing about continuing violence and also a generalized level of insecurity, crime, etc. But still, we had an end to the sort of bloody uprising that we witnessed early last year. However, we were unable, or it simply was not achieved, to enforce a transitional solution, to make it clear to the government that they were there with a very clear mandate, which was expressed in the agreement, in the agenda items, for a limited amount of time. Once the politicians once they formed their very grand coalition, one of the most inflated governments, if not the most bloated government in the world, which U.S. Ambassador Ranneberger at the time called the price of peace. And this happened at a time when Kenyans were demonstrating, including Nobel Prize laureate Wangari Maathai, against this bloated government. And Binaifa, you were there too. I think you got some of the tear gas that day. Yes, Kenyans demonstrated against what they saw as a risky experiment, but it was seen as the price for peace. I've lost my... Yes, the necessity for enforcing the failure to enforce this idea of a transitional government. We referred to it again and again as civil society, but obviously it would have been difficult, I suppose, to get the protagonists to sign onto an agreement, and while telling them you're only going to do this for a short time. But we felt that it was really a part of the problem. The momentum then moved away from the pressure which was being exercised on the protagonists, and that's another issue I would like to raise. And it then moved to the politicians, and some of their first acts were to raise their allowances, to increase their already very, very lucrative salaries. And another problem that civil society had with the political settlement was that it was reduced to an issue of a confrontation between the PNU and the ODM. And 30, how many other million Kenyans had nothing to say. So we feel that already there, in the lack of a transitional arrangement, because immediately politicians are given power, they of course settle into it and hope to make it last as long as possible. Yes, so agenda item 4. I'm sure Salim talked for much longer.
Oh. I was a bad moderator. Yeah. Making up for it now.
Yeah, okay. Okay, okay, fine. So I'm saying basically that there were a few institutional arrangements. There were some laws passed, but the germ of violence has already been laid for the next election. For example, when one looks at how the interim electoral body has been handled. Politicians have reduced everything to a matter of horse trading, ethnic pork barrel politics. And already any arrangement which arises out of the transactions happening today will not have the trust of Kenyans. So that apple is already poisoned in terms of the next elections. So generally, we have not seen very much progress since the last year, and we have not seen an awareness on the part of politicians of the extreme fragility of the situation. They have basically been playing with lighted matches near petrol, and I'm sure some of you read about the tragedy where Kenyans who are so impoverished that they look for any opportunity to earn a few pennies, an oil tanker turned over and people came running with containers to fill them and then sell the fuel, and over 100 people died in the explosion that ensued. And I think this is a metaphor for what the politicians are presently doing in Kenya. Just to talk about, I would agree that, put it very bluntly, the American ambassador has largely not helped the situation, and we look forward to the day when the Obama administration will appoint a new one. And that should be sooner rather than later, given the fragility of the situation. We've talked about institutional collapse over the years. Just to highlight it, you need to know the Kenyan judiciary, which has so little faith and confidence that one party in the flawed elections refused to consult the judiciary, and in which in many, many studies and surveys has simply... It simply doesn't enjoy the confidence of Kenyans. It has a backlog of over 800,000 cases. And this was something that the Minister for Justice was complaining about. One would wonder what she conceives of as her job. Apart from complaining about the collapse of the anti-corruption campaign, which also falls squarely within her brief. The police are increasingly a rogue force. I think Ben will talk more about that. We heard about the assassinations today. Special Rapporteur, UN Special Rapporteur Alston's report was a very, very clear condemnation of the security forces' involvement in basically brutalizing and killing Kenyans. The military has been involved in human rights abuses, which we'll hear more about, and that despite Ambassador Ranneberger congratulating them, I think yesterday, for being some of the most professional in Africa. I think the military's reluctance to intervene in politics has come more from the fact that the higher echelons of the military are just as implicated in the system of patronage and corruption as are the politicians, and they basically don't believe in rocking the boat, usually and largely, perhaps, thank God. The executive, we've heard about the bureaucracy or the higher echelons of the bureaucracy rolling back the mediation agreement and undermining it. The crisis of corruption. John Githongo has referred to corruption as the glue that holds the coalition together, and we agree with him. And that is probably the reason why politicians have an interest in continuing the mediation, this coalition government for as long as they can, because all sides are engaged in a veritable orgy of looting which takes some of the most reprehensible and egregious forms, such as the maize scandal at a time when so many Kenyans are starving. So we feel that we're standing on the edge of an abyss. It has to be realized that Kenya is in an extremely fragile situation. It is not as stable as it appears to be. We can no longer continue to believe the myth of Kenyan exceptionalism, where that won't happen here. It has happened, and it threatens to happen again with much greater force, given the lack of attention to the issues which gave rise to the crisis. And the risk of a relapse into violence is high. Indeed, it appears inevitable as 2012 approaches and very little is done about addressing the issues outlined in the mediation agreement. Kenyans don't want ethnic politics, but they seem to lack an alternative, and we don't know what the alternative will look like. And it's not at all guaranteed that that alternative will be a civil alternative or a very civilized alternative. Let us remember the existence of large groups of armed militia, disaffected youth, who have political claims to make. So we are, as civil society, conscious of the need for an alternative and conscious that it has to be recognized that the government is not really in a position to deliver reform. The coalition government cannot deliver reform. It can't. It has failed. And I think it's important to support, given the lack of an opposition, it is important to support the countervailing forces to the extent that they have the capacity to be a countervailing force in civil society, strengthen them in the media and in other and in the economy, because businessmen obviously and businesswomen are not satisfied, are not happy with the present situation and the performance of the government. So it's important to support that countervailing force, to counter a government which is increasingly unaccountable, does not listen to its people, and has no solution.
Thanks very much, Gladwell. I'd like to get back to that point in the discussion. Ben, you get the wrap-up, and Gladwell,
okay.
If you can turn
does
your
that,
mic
does
on.
That work? Okay.
Sorry.
I'd like to make 4 points, which I'll try and be brief because we've already had some overlap. Firstly, to talk about what I call criminal politics. Secondly, to talk about the response to that and to the violence. Thirdly, to just give you a little bit of a narrative about the research we've been doing into the security forces, the police and the army. And fourthly, I can't quite resist, but I just do want to make some policy recommendations about how to address impunity, in particular the role of the US. I think it's important to highlight again the depth of disillusionment in Kenya for anyone who's been there recently or who's in touch with the debates. It's really quite startling. There was a recent poll in the press where 70% of respondents, when asked what has the coalition government achieved, said nothing. The ethnicization, if you like, of politics and the violence that took place earlier in the year has resulted in a very different atmosphere in Kenya, a very different way of relating between people in government institutions, in schools, in hospitals, and very real realignments in geography, in previously mixed neighborhoods in Kibera, Mathari, and you know, whole sections of communities leaving the Rift Valley, leaving Central Province, going back to their respective homes in an ethnic sense. So the stage is really set for a lot of civil strife. The problem with the election that took place in December was not new. And when I was first sent in January last year, spent a lot of time in the Rift Valley and elsewhere collecting information, but the prevailing attitude in the international media was that Kenya was a hitherto stable state, and this was perceived as some kind of surprise. In fact, Human Rights Watch research in 1992 and 1997, other organizations doing the same work, the historical record is very clear. 1,500 people died in 1992, 1,500 people died in 97, 1,500 people died in 2008. The scale is, you know, was slightly bigger this time, but the dynamics are the same. And there has been a process set in play, I think initially under Moi, through using violence as a way to get elected, as a political strategy. It started off in the Rift Valley, and it's become increasingly a part of the strategy that politicians used to gain office. The counterpart to that is, of course, the institutionalized violence through rigging and through the suppression of dissent with the extrajudicial killing of opposition looters, rioters in Kisumu and in Nairobi. It's that kind of politics that needs to change, and I think that the agenda items 1 through 4 that were negotiated by Kofi Annan began to get at the root of the problem. Everyone, I think universally, inside and outside Kenya, welcomed the coalition government, which put a lid on the violence. They welcomed the apparent roadmap for peace and reconciliation, what was called the National Accord, or the National Dialogue for Reconciliation. But the progress over the last year has been the story of the abandoning and the burying of those principles. For example, the international, Independent Review Commission of the Election, the Kriegler Commission, did not live up to the expectations of many in its analysis of the problem. The Wacky Commission, on the other hand, an excellent report whose recommendations have so far been stalled. I'm going to get on to the Special Tribunal and debate about the ICC in a minute. But the story of Parliament's burying of that effort, I think, is very instructive for how the country might think about going forwards and addressing issues of accountability. There are many other outstanding human rights issues which I don't have time to talk about now, but the bulk of IDPs are in fact still IDPs. In transit camps, they were forced by the government to leave the main refugee IDP camps into transit camps, many of them sent home without the compensation and the kind of help that they were supposed to receive in order to rebuild their lives. An awful lot of resentment there. The May scandal, it's been mentioned by other people, but I've spoken to quite a few humanitarian experts who say that, in fact, although, yes, there is a drought, over 50% of the increase in maize price and in the shortage of food that people are experiencing is man-made. The government controls the economy, the maize economy. It's in a position to manipulate inputs, outputs, supply and demand, and also to nominate who gets to benefit from the spreading around, from the buying of the maize from the National Reserve and the selling and so on, at what price. So a lot of money's been made there, but also a lot of people are having their right to food impinged as a result. Let me just say then a little bit about the police and the military, the security forces, before I get on to the Special Tribunal and some recommendations on accountability. Despite all these nice noises, Agenda 1 through 4, an apparent commitment to the rule of law and a reform process for Kenya, one of the first actions of the new government, as it were, was the joint police-military operation in Mount Elgon, which began on March the 10th, 2008, and involved the forceful roundup of between 3,000 and 4,000 men in Mount Elgon district on the border with Uganda, in response to an ongoing counterinsurgency there that had been led by a group of politicians. The militia were called the Sobot Land Defense Force. There's an ongoing land grievance there. However, it had become politicized, and it essentially, in the run-up to the election, became about getting elected and eliminating opponents. The heavy-handed response to that counterinsurgency was, as I say, a forceful roundup of around 4,000 men, detaining them in a military camp, torture, asking them to reveal the whereabouts of other SLDF supporters and weapons. Around 800 were charged and detained. The majority of them were later released because there were no charges. There was no evidence to press charges. Around 200 were extrajudicially killed, according to local NGOs and also confirmed by the Special Rapporteur's recent report last week. And around 100 of those remain unaccounted for. The Kenyan government's response was there was no torture in Mount Elgon. British and American and other military forces have some responsibility there in terms of their training of the Kenyan army, not necessarily the units who were in Mount Elgon, but their military relationship with the Kenyan army, and in holding those people to account, and holding the individuals to account, but also the strategy. Now, what's particularly worrying about Mount Elgon, when you then consider the next joint police-military security operation that the government undertook in October, this time it was a disarmament exercise designed to put down tribal clashes in Mandera district, in the far, if you're looking at Kenya, the far top next to Ethiopia and Somalia. That involved, again, the forceful rounding up of between 2,000 and 3,000 people, the rape of women, the beating and torturing of those men, asking them to hand over weapons, then the confiscation of their ID cards, asking them to go, giving them then 3 days to go and bring guns in order to get their ID cards back. The elders in each case organized delegations to raise money, go to Somalia, buy weapons, bring them back again, and hand them to the military so that they could get their ID cards back. I personally interviewed quite a few female rape victims. There was a lot of looting, a lot of beating of women and children too. The Red Cross treated 1,200 victims in mobile clinics that went throughout the villages of Mandera district the following week. One person died, as far as we know, and a lot were referred to district hospitals. That does not solve whatever insecurity problems there may be in Mandera. The militia, who may have been causing those tribal, who were in fact fighting and causing the instability there, retreated over the border into Ethiopia and into Somalia, leaving the residents of those towns to suffer the full force of the security operation. One man put it very well to me. He said, where were they when we were getting killed by the militia? They don't seem to be able to keep the peace, so they take it out on us. They can't find the enemy, so they come and find us. There's two other instances. There was not a joint police military operation, but a police operation in Kuria district last month, where the general service unit, the paramilitary unit of the police, went again village by village in a purportedly disarmament operation to try and stop cattle rustling on the border. We didn't investigate that, but in the press there are lots of reports of very similar nature: beatings, rapes, lootings. And now this week in Samburu, again, there is reports of cattle rustling have been followed by reports of a very heavy-handed, brutal security operation to try and control the situation. One policeman I spoke to said, well, you know, the only way you deal with these, with this instability is to let them know that the government is there. So it seems very strange that, to me anyway, that this is the way of dealing with security policy, if you like. So, I think it touches on something Salim said earlier, which is that the coalition, the power-sharing arrangement, has not resulted in power-sharing. There is a core government within a government, which is the office of the president. The Ministry of Internal Security, the Ministry of Defense, are both within the office of the president. So it seems like an increasingly sort of pressurized and perhaps paranoid government within a government is trying to conduct security with a very big stick in a very heavy-handed way, which is doing nothing to respect human rights and doing everything to, in fact, encourage disaffection and fragmentation. Philip Alston, the special rapporteur for the UN on extrajudicial killings, recommended that the police commissioner be sacked and that the attorney general resign. And he also said that the attorney general was the embodiment of impunity in Kenya. That's an opinion I think I'd agree with, and that would be one of the first things that I would point to in terms of four brief recommendations on how to address impunity. 2 minutes. There has seemed to be, anyway, of late, a kind of a drift in US policy, not really sure how to solve Kenya, as it were, how to make a contribution, an awareness that there's a big problem, an awareness that accountability and impunity are at the heart of the crisis of governance, but not really sure about how to go forward on that. The first thing, I think there are opportunities here, and there are very small strategic things that could be done, discrete efforts that could be made. The first thing is that the US did sign on with other European embassies calling, supporting Philip Alston's report. Now, if you fully support Philip Alston's report, then you would also step that up with some recommendations for the police commissioner to go and for the attorney general to go. The police has an appalling record, and over the last year, it's got even worse, not to mention the 1,000 or so people extrajudicially killed in relation to the Mungiki problems in Nairobi. Secondly is the military relationship. I'm pleased to say that the US does appear to be taking the Leahy law vetting seriously now and is looking quite carefully at the people that it does train, and I think that sends a very good deterrent message to the Kenyan army that this kind of behavior, as much as they might claim it's the police, to the security force in general, that this kind of this way of undertaking security operations is not good. Finally, on the special tribunal, the US has not really been much in favor of the International Criminal Court options, not really been that much in favor of the special tribunal either. The reason why the special tribunal is so important, and I agree with Salim, but I don't quite agree on the fact that it's all or nothing. You have to start somewhere. And in order to have a government that is capable of governing, those people have to know that the way to government is not paved with violence. So you have to hold the politicians to account first. You have to try and change the politics. You have to change the tone of politics so that the way to get elected is not to fund a militia, but is actually to make arguments and have a legal election campaign. There has been a lot of debate in civil society, a lot of disillusion about the special tribunal, the idea that Kenyan institutions can't deal with the problem. Let's just send it to the ICC. As we all know, the ICC is not a viable, timely option. That will take time. The idea of the Waki Commission was that the ICC would be a sting in the tail to encourage the setting up of the special tribunal. He didn't give MPs a choice, and yet the debate in Kenya has been as though Parliament holds this, is charged with making this decision between whether it should be the ICC or the special tribunal. No. Waki said to Parliament and to the government, make this special tribunal happen, otherwise I go to The Hague. So his recommendations should be honoured, we believe, and we believe he made a very good and clear assessment of the problem. Perhaps I'll stop there. We can get into the detail about the special tribunal.
Thank you all for great presentations. One thing on the police and military professionalism, I mean, it is something of a dilemma because, presumably a large part of U.S. training of military forces is professionalism and instilling kind of ethic and civil military ethics. And I think that's been a debate here. And do you actually need more training not to disengage entirely? As far as a U.S. engagement process, I think that's a big question there. Although, obviously, upholding the high standards and calling militaries with whom you do engage to account when abuses do occur. But Gladwell, I wanted to ask you about how the crisis has changed kind of the nature of civil society, if it has, and if you see within civil society much more kind of cross-cutting. You know, there's on the one hand the tendency that Ben spoke of kind of more rigid ethnic divisions among communities and so forth, but I wonder if civil society now is kind of expanding in that way, if there's this general disgust with the political elite altogether that may be, you know, cutting across some of the ethnic differences. I know, you know, here in Washington, when one party wins, you know, they come out and they come work for think tanks, and when the others, you know, we're seeing a big outflow that way. But in Kenya, it seems much more fluid now, and I wonder if you might talk about that. But let's take a few together, and then turn back to the panel. We have about 10 minutes due to my poor time management up here. Gentlemen here, and if you could identify yourself, and the mic is coming.
Okay, thank you. My name is Jan van Leeuwen. Thank you very much for your presentation. Ben, you said that there was quite a consensus about the importance of this unity government. I'm afraid I totally disagree. I think there were quite a lot of people who, right from the start, thought this was nonsense. It was not going to work. And for some of the reasons that Gladwell has already pointed out, everybody had a chance to go to the trough. And once they were out there, there was no incentive whatsoever for them to make this a temporary transitional solution. And I think it was very frightful that actually somewhere about 4 or 5 months ago, the Kenya solution was being proposed as a potential for Zimbabwe. Again, it's just not going to work. I think in Kenya, with the challenges that were there at that time, which have only gotten worse since, it should have been an action-oriented technocratic government, maybe. I mean, this is very naive from my point of view, but I just don't understand why Mr. Kofi Annan. I can understand that he wanted to stop the violence, but in doing so, they were failing totally to address the core reasons for the violence. And as Gladwell has said so clearly, the stage has been set for a much worse explosion 2 years from now. A very specific question I have. I've been doing some Googling the last couple of weeks, and what throws in my face is, of course, the reasons of all this corruption, is that right from the start, from independence, there was almost an encouragement for politicians to get involved in business. And so there is a constant intertwining and conflict of interest there, and it goes from the right from the top down to the lower levels of government. I asked this about last year at the session, and I would like to ask you again, is there any recognition in the society of the importance of getting some sort of conflict of interest type of legislation, which then gets in implicated as well, so that politicians, be it the family of Mr. Odinga who are in the oil business, the family of the president who are in the cereal business, these boards that are everywhere that are basically set up to be corrupted, is there any initiative or any thinking process going on to address these core problems that I think are part of the corrupt picture right now? Thank you.
Lawrence Freeman from ER Magazine at the African Desk. I'm a little bit concerned about discussion of the ICC. I think the decision was an abomination and will actually spread war throughout Sudan and Horn of Africa. But in principle, I think it's a terrible way to go, because you have an independent organization which in part was created by Malik Brown of the Foreign Office of Britain and George Soros of these various organizations. And they say they have the right to intervene and determine sovereignty over a nation. I think that's absolutely wrong. Nations are the sovereign. They're the highest form of law. And we should be conducting policies to help Kenya economically and otherwise develop. But to have an international body come in and decide what a country can do or not do that has no standing in law and has no constituency, I think is a grave mistake. And I wanted to know if people would talk to that.
I think Kenya is a signatory to the ICC, so that, maybe that makes some difference. But, okay, we have one in the... Let's go with the
John Harbison Seiss. I would like to hear Salim, and maybe any one of the three of you, in principle, an approach to dealing with a land issue. I don't begin to understand even where you start to deal with a land issue.
In 3 minutes or less, and then we had one in the far back, and I'm afraid we're going to have to limit it there. We do have another panel coming.
My name is Scott Poole with the International Republican Institute, and my comment is actually directed towards the comment on our exit poll. There was a comment about being outraged about allowing a flawed election being able to stand. We would agree with that comment and maybe even take it a little bit further and say that we shouldn't allow flawed polling data to necessarily stand. That we had, for a variety of reasons, there were concerns about the quality of the product we were getting from our local partner. We had the forms, over 6,000 questionnaires shipped to the U.S., where we had another firm do a double entry system, where two coders had to agree that the questionnaire was correct before it was entered into a new data set. So we rebuilt the file from scratch. Then we compared the file that our local partner had put together in Kenya with the new file that had been created from this double data entry system. When we compared the two files, there were over 50% of the questionnaires had at least one mistake from our polling partner in Kenya. So with that, let me share some information, because there's been a lot of emphasis placed on who won. And I think the comments today are not about who won, but looking forward. here's some of the things that we can determine about Election Day. That about 80% of the Kenyans on Election Day felt that things were free and fair. So maybe that adds to the credibility of the Waki report that the election violence is a manufactured political situation. We also can look at that election data, and this gentleman's comment about the skepticism about a unity government working on the terms of the economy. 89% of Kibaki supporters thought that the economy was great. 83% of Odinga supporters thought it was poor.
The question is that
data can help us move forward in this process. Bad data gives us bad results. And so as you're looking forward, what sources of information are you looking in towards putting a roadmap together for the future? And that is kind of the basic part. And because you can see that there is a dichotomy between Kibaki supporters and Odinga supporters based on the election data poll, which would suggest that the unity government is in trouble. And so how do you go about bringing this divide back together?
Okay. Because we are running out of time, I'm going to have to turn back to the panel to wrap up those questions. There'll be more opportunities for questions in the second panel. Why don't we start with you, Salim, and you can take on which
ones
you want.
I'll be very brief. No. On the IRI, first of all, I think you have to accept that if you decide at the end of Election Day that you're not going to release that data because it's flawed, you've got a problem on your hands because people are going to believe that it was politically decided, whether you're right or wrong. In any event, it so happens that the results of the actual election, which we believe on television, Raila winning by nearly 1 million votes, coincide with the IRI exit poll. So I'm not a technician on those issues, so that's my answer to that particular question. On the question of legislation, it wasn't merely politicians. Actually, the decision that was made was that civil servants who were not allowed to participate in businesses were given permission under the Digwa report under Kenyatta a long time ago. But let me say this. I'm all for such legislation. No problem with it. But the problem in Kenya is not legislation. It is how people are able to get around it, and there is no accountability. So that's not a solution. It's certainly a welcome development. I think we're running out of time. I won't say
that. Okay, you. Thank you. That's and Gladwell.
Yeah, I also would like to leave more time to the panel that's going to follow.
So on civil society's changing nature, I think this crisis very briefly brought together organizations which usually exist in silos. You have your human rights, your governance, gender, and here we were forced, we came together and exchanged information, and I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the ways that we've been able to work together. So very briefly, yes, I think there was a change. Whether we're able to learn from that, systematize it, and move forward with lessons based on that is a challenge to us.
Okay, maybe I'll just... Yeah, sorry.
I will also not. I'm not able really to say anything on the land. There's been a lot of work done and a draft land policy produced. I don't know whether it can just be taken off the shelf and dusted off and implemented. But definitely, there's been there's been absolutely no real commitment, despite rhetorical statements once in a while, to actually address the issue. You'll never address it once and for all, but to begin seriously addressing it.
The interesting thing about the ICC point is that the argument for voting down the special tribunal in the Kenyan parliament was because they don't trust, MPs said, they don't trust Kenyan courts, so let's send it to the ICC. So if parliament, in fact... Parliament has, in effect, made a decision requesting Annan to hand over that envelope to the ICC, which, funnily enough, Human Rights Watch and other civil society organizations in Kenya are not 100% supportive of. We're not 100% supportive of that because we would like to see, a better approach for Kenya is to deal with the problems itself. The principles of the Rome Statute are that you... try and move towards judicial reform and decent structures, and the ICC is there as a last resort and as a kind of a stick to make that reform happen. The problem with the whole debate about how to get accountability in Kenya is that MPs have been bought off left, right, and centre. So, in fact, you had the people who are arguing for The Hague in the Kenyan Parliament are, in fact, the ones who are afraid of a special tribunal. And this is the point I'd like to get across to the US administration, is that the special tribunal, this is not an either-or choice. Kenya has a responsibility under its own constitution, under the Rome Statute, to hold people to account who violate its laws. Like, that has to happen, whether it's a special tribunal or under the High Court or in whatever way it chooses, that has to happen. This is not a choice between the ICC and dealing with it locally. The ICC, in any case, could only deal with half a dozen cases. So, a special tribunal is the best option because nobody has faith in the existing judiciary. So the whole point of the Wacky Commission was, let's set up something separate with international judges so we can try and make it more robust. Anan and his panel has a role in selecting some of those people, in having an oversight. Cecile will talk more about this in the second panel. But the US and other donors and the Europeans are particularly enthusiastic about this, as is Kenyan civil society, as is Human Rights Watch and other organizations, human rights organizations. But the US has been dragging its feet because it doesn't want to support something that might not work. Now, it might not work, but it's the best option. It's the best hope for some kind of accountability for this. And it's the only real first step that can possibly be made in trying to change politics so we don't get this violent currency of politics where the one who gets elected is the one who has control over the electoral commission or the one who has the most guns. You know, that's the Nigerian way of doing things, which I think most Kenyans would not like to be associated with.
Comment, then we're going to take a very brief kind of leg-stretching break.
Very quickly on land, let me say that probably the most outstanding minister we have is the Minister for Lands, but he's hobbled by lots of stuff, including people who own vast tracts of land who are in government who never agree to land reform. But number two, just want to point out one simple fact to show you how little has been learned. This problem started with the rigging of the election. Parliament, which has been a huge disappointment to everyone, had to select the commissioners and the chairman of the new ECK. And they rigged that election of the ECK. We had Maina Kiai as one of the candidates, who is way ahead of anyone else in competence and in integrity, but that's beside the point. The fact is they chose somebody corruptly to head the ECK. So this is how little has been learned. And the international community, let me conclude by saying again, must get involved in crafting a solution, not merely giving advice that no one is listening to. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take just a very quick break and come back with Maina, Professor Kagwanja, and Cecile Aptel. 3 minutes.